Nonprofit organizations abound in our world, and we're used to nonprofits that help feed people, house people, provide radio or library services. A lot of non-corporate type functions is the way we think of them. But today's guest thinks nonprofits can get involved in much more. Donnie McClurkin is the founder of the Post Growth Institute, which imagines a future without the constant desire for economic growth. He also teaches at Southern Oregon University and runs Cascades Hub. He can explain what that's all about. At the moment, Cascades Hub is running a multiple-week training for nonprofit leaders and workers, something of a tune-up. So, Donnie McClurkin, good to have you back on the Jefferson Exchange.
Great to be here, Jeffrey. Thanks for having me.
You wear so many hats. Why don't you give the short bio, the one that takes a couple of sentences?
Well, I run an international economics institute based here at Southern Oregon University. And alongside that, I work with local nonprofit organizations to, as you said, really help tune up and move towards business models. And to do that through what's a place that's called the Cascades Hub, based on the campus here.
At the Cascades Dining Hall?
That's right, up in the Cascades building in the back left of the campus.
Okay, so you took an obvious name there. But it seems like these things you do work together. I mean, you are really seeing a future in which nonprofits will become much more important and much more widespread than they are now.
Absolutely, and it's based on what's happened over the last 15 years, some incredible things. So if you look at what happened in the U.S. in that decade that encompassed the financial crises, you actually saw more nonprofit organizations emerge than for-profit businesses, full stop. The actual number was bigger over that period. You also saw those organizations have an increase in their salaries that was greater as a percentage of salaries than in the for-profit sector. And you also saw them add greater numbers of people in terms of employment. Now, how could that happen in an era where we had a financial crisis, given nonprofits are, as we traditionally know them, supported by the for-profit sector, philanthropy, grants, etc.? The reality is that nonprofits have been changing, and they've been bringing in business models that sit underneath what they do, such that they become more independent in their activities. And that's what I'm engaged in, and is a common thread in a lot of my work, is, first of all, introducing people to the concept of not-for-profit enterprise, nonprofit enterprises, and then secondly, helping them to actually move in that direction with their work to show that not-for-profits themselves, and that includes nonprofit organizations, various forms of cooperative and other forms of business that don't privatize wealth, that don't have shareholders as such, that take dividends, that those forms of business can actually be very, very successful and point the path to a new economy globally.
But if they don't make profits then, and they don't have shareholders, then it's not like anybody's going to get rich off of them.
Right. Although they do make profits, or they can make profits, mm-hmm. It's just that they can't distribute those to any shareholders. So if you take, for example, a consumer cooperative like the Ashland Food Co-op or the Medford Food Co-op, both of those have what's called members, but they're nominal members. So any money that they get back is in what's called a patronage dividend at the end of the year, that the board of that co-op says we'd like to give some money back because we've got enough to invest and we've got enough to actually provide what's a refund to people. That is actually just a refund because, remember, it's people's money that they're purchasing things with. So any return of that is not actually a dividend like in the share market where you get money back on top of your investment. It's just a return on what you've already spent as a percentage of your spending.
So there was something you said about the nonprofit model that sits underneath businesses. I didn't quite understand what you meant that.
Also, in fact, the opposite, where you actually look at business sitting underneath a nonprofit model. So you take a typical organization in the arts, which would commonly have some kind of philanthropy that supports it or is grants-based. But then you look at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival here, and you realize that only 3% of its budget actually comes from that philanthropic sources. The rest of it relies on a business model that essentially sells ticket sales as well as membership packages. And so it's actually running as a business with some philanthropy to support it, but it's very much different from the nonprofits of old in the arts field that were entirely grants or philanthropically supported.
I get it. It's almost like seeing the amount of DNA from the profit-making world and the nonprofit world get mixed up in companies, and some have more than others.
That's right. That's why people often refer to these as hybrids, essentially. But what I'm interested in is less of the hybrids in the new fields like benefit corporations, which remain for-profit, can still have shareholders. And what most excites me is where these hybrids actually emerge within nonprofit organizations. So if you take Goodwill, for example, or the Schneider Children's Center here at SOU, or even State Farm Insurance, all of these are actually non-profit, well, not for-profit organizations. They're, legally, there's the difference between a non-profit organization, which is typically a 501c3 if they have tax exemption. But I like to refer to not-for-profit as an adjective rather than a noun, rather than a legal structure, and look at what are all the kinds of business that aren't returning profits to shareholders and thereby extracting wealth from a community. What are all the organizations or companies that are putting wealth back in because they have that not-for-profit motive and activity underneath their business?
You said State Farm Insurance.
State Farm Insurance is a mutual insurance company. So that means that all the members are the owners. There's no shareholders as such. And any of the profits can either go back into State Farm or will go back to the insurance holders by way of lower premiums or sometimes patronage dividends. It's the same with the credit union system. Every credit union in the US is a not-for-profit institution. There are no private shareholders of those organizations, and all of the profits go back into the communities in which they're involved.
So so what do they do then? I mean, what is the earmarking generally for anything that comes in over the revenue that comes in over expenses?
That depends on the bylaws of each company. So, for example, with the credit unions in the Valley, some of them have philanthropic programs where they actually support other nonprofits through their work. So that's a novel concept for lots of people, thinking about nonprofits that actually support other nonprofits through philanthropy. And for others, they will look to keeping capital reserves. So this is why the credit union system in the US is so strong, because rather than their profits actually going out to shareholders that aren't related to the business, they have often save up and create capital reserves that mean that they can actually be stronger when the troubles hit the fan, basically.
All right. Much more to talk about the way that the not-for-profit, we'll try to stop calling them non-profits, use Donnie's terminology, not-for-profit entities put themselves together, and how he helps train them in Cascades Hub. Donnie McClurkin's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll be happy to take phone calls and emails from you about a future in which nonprofits are potentially more important. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange with Donnie McClurkin in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest today is Donnie McClurkin. Last time he visited, he was wearing the hat of the Post Growth Institute. He does believe that the future could be a lot brighter if we stop thinking in terms of constant economic growth. He is also the head of Cascades Hub and a professor at Southern Oregon University, I guess an associate professor. We'll get to the terminology in a second. But you can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk specifically about not-for-profit organizations and how they stay in business or keep going, and how Donnie and his people help tune them up at Cascades Hub. He's in the middle of a multi-week training program. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange with questions or comments. 800-838-3760 around the listening area. 800-838-3760. Or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Are people often, you find, somewhat limited in their thinking in the sense that it's hard to wrap their minds around not-for-profit organizations doing things other than charitable-type functions?
Absolutely. When we started this project about 5 years ago, looking at the power of not-for-profit enterprise as we saw it rising around the world, we found that the difficulty that you allude to there was very much pervasive. What we then found was a technique that's had really great cut through, which is essentially to remind people or take people through the journey we've been on. Because my experience growing up as a teenager in Australia was exactly the same, that not-for-profit meant, or non-profit meant, a certain thing. It meant charitable, it meant volunteer-run, it usually meant bureaucratic, old-school structures, and it was very much only focused on social welfare sort of aspects within the communities. What changed that for me was in 2009, being at a conference where a gentleman got up and talked about his engineering firm. And this was a group that had 50 employees, $17 million turnover, and they were working in civil engineering and construction and surveying. And then he said the words that really changed my journey, which was, "And we're not for profit." And he described how his organization had set up and said, "We just want to put back into the community, do good work, And essentially, we need to pay good wages. And beyond that, we don't need to come out of this seeking massive riches.
Was this somewhat akin to having an automotive company say, hey, we're not for profit?
Well, that's interesting you raise that, because Henry Ford wanted to take Ford not-for-profit back in the 20s. And in fact, for 7 years, the Ford company was not-for-profit, with the Ford Foundation owning all of the shares.
Really?
Yeah. There was a challenge when Ford wanted to do that because the Dodge brothers had 10% shares, and it was a famous case that went to court. But there is, for example, an automotive manufacturing company in Seattle called Wikispeed that's not-for-profit. And they had exactly the same issues, because this person behind this, Joe Justice, just wanted to create 100 mile per gallon vehicles. He wanted to create an engineering approach to car manufacturing that was much more sustainable. And he found that when the venture capitalists kept approaching him about creating this company, because they'd heard about all the ideas that he was trialing, what they wanted was their pound of flesh. They essentially wanted total control of this project. They wanted the intellectual property to be totally wrapped up. And he said, stuff it. We're going to set up a not-for-profit. We're going to run it as a not-for-profit company. And it's had huge success, Wikispeed has, around the world, drawing in engineers and all sorts of planners, and have had success in actually building very, very sustainable vehicles with rapid iteration processes.
Which gets back to the whole idea, though, of how fast things can grow when there's not an infusion of capital. I mean, when you're talking about not doing the old stock model with shareholders and everything, I mean, you get fast infusions of cash through that kind of system, and your company can potentially grow fast, your operation, even if it's not a company that makes things. There must be some limits, then, to what can happen with not-for-profits.
You'd think so, but there's actually very few these days, because the game changed in the last 10 years in terms of capital infusion on two fronts. Firstly, we've seen new forms of capital raising that are opening up to non-profit organizations. So you have crowdfunding, you have various forms of donation, which are the traditional forms, but you also have some exciting new forms like community public offerings. And we've now got a platform here in Oregon just recently launched called The Hatch, where if I'm a nonprofit founder and I want to raise $200,000, $2 million, $20 million, whatever it is, I can now put out the equivalent of a direct public offering. But instead of offering equity in the company, I'm basically putting out a request for loans. And that is something that has existed in the past in terms of any nonprofit organization can approach a bank for a loan. But now Oregon individuals can invest up to $2,500, I believe, into nonprofit organizations en masse to actually fund the startup of these organizations. And we have the nonprofit equivalent of venture capital, which is called revenue-based finance, which again is about focusing on loan-based money rather than equity. This is very exciting developments. Community bonds and social impact bonds are another form that are particularly predominant in Canada at the moment, and I think will emerge in the US in the future. But these aren't forms of revenue that existed in terms of that capital raising in the past, and it changes the game. And on top of that, you've got the falling costs of production. Essentially, the 15 projects that are going through our program at the moment are realizing from day one the thought that they needed $100,000 to set up an organization in the Southern Oregon region gets blown away in the very first few minutes, where we actually look at the strengths that they're sitting on and what they can utilize already and what the internet has done to bring down costs in terms of marketing, communications, operations, etc.
Donnie McClurkin's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's the head of Cascades Hub. We're talking about not-for-profit organizations and how they do business in the world now and in the future. So the direct public offering idea, where you're giving a loan, I mean, you expect to get the exact amount back and no more?
It's totally written up in the agreement, essentially, the contract, and because it's with a nonprofit organization, it's not even considered a security, so it's not covered, I believe, under securities law, but there's still an arrangement. So it might be that there's a 2 or 3% return that's anticipated, essentially, with that loan, and that's up to the organization that's offering that money to say what they believe that return is going to be. And of course, with any of these things, like with any form of investment, there's a risk involved. But essentially, with nonprofits, I would argue that the risk is much lower, because to have a solid nonprofit business plan that is essentially putting forward a notion of a direct public offering requires a lot more stringent consideration than a for-profit business plan that usually is. Venture capital expects 3/4 of, or if not more, of these businesses to fail. That's not what we're seeing in terms of people launching nonprofits. If people are going to put $2,500 in a low return nonprofit bond, essentially, they're going to be much more careful about thinking about it. Is that actually going to work in the future?
So it's a more cautious proposition. It sounds like from the outset, lower risk, but lower reward potentially too. But the emphasis on lower risk.
It could be. But in Australia, for example, where ABC Learning Centres took over post-crash from the government learning centres, and this was the major provider of childhood learning in Australia, the return was 13% on loaned money in. So it's not necessarily, I mentioned 2 or 3% before because I'm guessing that's probably more the standard, but it doesn't have to be that low necessarily.
Not surprisingly, we've lit a fire under a few of our listeners, so here's some calls coming in. Here's Ryan and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Donnie McClurkin.
Well, as is often the case, Jeffrey, this is an absolutely fascinating conversation, so thank you. And thank you, Donnie. I work for the state, and I'm really intrigued by a lot of the synergies between this public good, public benefit, new corporate structures, and in particularly that, you know, incentivizing that comes from some risk-taking of stockholders, but then to create a corporate entity that's more of a benefit organization. This is fantastic, and I'm wondering about the role of a community bank and or a state bank who could collect money specifically to make it available for these kinds of enterprises.
All right, community banks or state banks. Thanks for that, Ryan. Good to hear from you.
Thank you.
Ryan, that's a really, really great point you raise. Ellen Brown in particular has led that move in this country, writing about public banking alternative. We've seen incredible results in North Dakota with their public bank and what's happened.
Which I know we've had people on the program saying, why don't we do this in Oregon?
Right. So there actually are, I believe, over 20 state proposals at the moment currently under review in the legislature.
But just the one bank in North Dakota, state bank?
But one that exists at the moment. But Vermont had a recent move in that direction. Hasn't happened yet. But I think you're absolutely right, Ryan, that there is immense potential, and for listeners that may not be familiar with the community bank or the state bank model, essentially think about the state actually running its own bank, and any of its money that it brings in through revenue comes in as a deposit essentially to its own bank. And it essentially, therefore, subverts the need for some forms of taxation because the interest that it makes, the profits that it makes from interest on loans out, actually then provide the state with greater revenue rather than being siphoned off out of the community. And that's what in North Dakota has been used to actually expand public works. And the amazing thing about community banks or state banks, community banks being the local version of a state bank, so if the city council, for example, sets up its own bank that it owns, the amazing thing is those banks have a mandate to increase lending during downturns. That is fascinating if you think about it, because it actually ensures, it's almost a Keynesian approach that ensures you actually see an economy pumped up when it's in its most difficult times and no one is siphoning off the wealth through that process.
If the requirement is there to increase lending during downtimes, does that mean they're supposed to decrease lending? Is there a mandate for that too in up times?
No, obviously they're meant to look at this on a needs basis, but they do have a mandate to increase it during that downturn, which I think is a really smart move for economies that are in flux these days.
Well, the question I wrote down was, how is a community bank different from a credit union? But I think you already answered the question that it is an entity of some local government.
That's right. So just as the cities across the U.S., have municipal entities. They may run the water supply. They may run the fiber network. They may run the electricity system. It's the community bank is the equivalent of that in terms of a municipally run and owned entity as compared to a fully community-owned entity, which is in the form of a credit union.
Donnie McClurkin is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's the head of Cascades Hub and the Post Growth Institute and a teacher at Southern Oregon University. We're talking primarily about not-for-profit entities and all the good they can do in the world and his big belief in them. And he's also training them to do better right now. We'll talk about that in a few moments. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange with questions or comments at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. 800-838-3760. Email is jx@jeffnet.org. Let's go to Mike in Eagle Point. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Donnie McClurkin.
Good morning, gentlemen. I'm curious about whether things that call themselves co-ops fit under the umbrella that your guest is talking about, things like the Ashland Food Co-op, the Grange Co-op, and if memory serves, I could be wrong about this, but I think at one time REI called themselves a co-op. So I appreciate any enlightenment your guests can offer on that subject.
All right. Thanks for that, Mike. Appreciate it.
Mike, that's a great question. Absolutely, certain forms of cooperative are non-profit and certain forms are for-profit. And it's a distinction that is poorly known even within the cooperative movement itself. The majority of cooperatives in the US are not for-profit. So any form of consumer cooperative, including REI, which you're right, still is a consumer cooperative, the Ashland Food Co-op, the Medford Co-op, these are all consumer cooperatives that essentially involve a bunch of members who've come together and they patron the establishment, and then any profits can be returned as a dividend, essentially, a patronage dividend to those members. The Grange Co-op is a little different, as is Ace Hardware, another cooperative. In these forms, these are actually associations of businesses, and that's why they're still considered for-profit, in the sense that if I own one of these businesses and I'm joining together to essentially reduce procurement costs, the costs of buying things, then if I own one of these franchises and I have a good year, then I can make a lot of money as an individual out of this. There's that cap that exists within the consumer cooperative movement. No one individual can be making a whole lot of money out of the setup. There are lots of other forms, though, of non-profit or not-for-profit cooperatives. So you've got housing cooperatives, many of which are not-for-profit. You have community land trusts. You have kindergarten and daycare programs, which are not-for-profit cooperatives as well, that are strong in the US. And you have electricity co-ops, which are particularly strong in rural America, where I believe 45% of the population is are members of consumer of electricity cooperatives, which are themselves consumer co-ops. And I think it's really interesting to be reminded of the biggest not-for-profit form of cooperative in the US, which is the credit union movement, with over 100 million members now. That's an incredible amount of people that are actually doing their banking with a not-for-profit institution, even though it only constitutes 10% of the overall capital. The numbers are an incredible achievement for this country.
And I'm going to guess the banking industry hears footsteps, because there have been many congressional efforts to limit the scope of what the credit unions can do in terms of membership, generally sponsored by the banking industry.
Absolutely. In fact, in Canada back in the 70s, the for-profit banks were so frustrated with the not-for-profit credit unions that they lobbied the government to actually ensure that all credit unions became for-profit in Canada, because they were sick of being outcompeted by the not-for-profit credit unions. Fortunately, I don't think that kind of change in legislation is possible anymore in the US, because there's such a movement behind this. You hear the rustles of, well, why do they get tax exemptions as credit unions? That's anti-competition. But the fact is, they get tax exemptions because they're not in it to make people rich as individuals. They're in it to make communities rich. And that's the key distinction. A non-profit organization or a not-for-profit form of organization is focused on community outcomes, not individual incomes.
Outcomes, not incomes. Okay, good tagline to work with there. Let's go to Wolfgang in Sunny Valley. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Donnie McClurkin. We're talking about not-for-profit organizations.
Yeah, good morning. I have a few points, and please bear with me. There's an anecdote, and it's a true anecdote. Somebody who couldn't find a job started a nonprofit to teach people how to find a job and created himself a job. So that's sort of the background. Mm-hmm. But more seriously, there is an underlying dynamic. Most nonprofits are dedicated to address some problem. And just like a doctor who wouldn't be in business if there were no sick people, these nonprofits have little interest in fixing the problem because their market would disappear. Instead, what they mostly do is they inform, they print brochures, they actually raise the public awareness of the problem and increase their market. Okay, so then that's basically a contradictory intentionality. And then when we go to the numbers, there are, if you look at non-profit 990s, you very often find parallel organizations where you can't follow the money anymore. And where that goes is what's called program services. The non-profit buys program services from an organization that's for-profit. And I know one case were a huge $25 million for-profit organization actually created a whole network of nonprofits as a market for their consulting services. So the tendency, or the let's say the likelihood to figure, wait a minute, this is a racket, is very, very great. And that harms the good nonprofits.
Okay, let's get a response. Thanks for that, Wolfgang. Appreciate it.
Wolfgang, you raise a really great point, which is there a dependency mentality that's being perpetuated here by these emerging nonprofits? I think it's important first to step back and actually look at where a lot of social challenges are now emerging. I would argue that they're actually emerging from the rise in social inequality that sits underneath the ongoing expansion of the for-profit system. We've moved now from a space of economic growth into uneconomic growth. And in terms of the notion of non-profit organizations hiring for-profit businesses, I think the key thing here is to remember that there's a doctrine of no private inurement that sits underneath non-profit organizations. In other words, they're not able to set things up for their friends in a way that there's a conflict of interest there. So what we're working with organizations these days is non-profit organizations actually looking at how do we go beyond expanding this notion of dependency and need?
Okay, let's hold it there, and we'll come back to the idea of dependency and need and how to avoid that. Donnie McClurkin's our guest on The Exchange. We're talking about not-for-profit organizations. We'll talk more with him and take phone calls and emails on the Jefferson Exchange in 1 minute. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking today about not-for-profit organizations, which are not necessarily the same thing as nonprofits. We'll clear that up with Donnie McClurkin before the hour's out. He is an affiliate professor at Southern Oregon University, the head of the Post Growth Institute, which sees a future that involves a lot more not-for-profit operations. He's also the head of Cascades Hub, which at the moment is about halfway through a multi-week training program for nonprofit leaders to get them to tune things up and up their game just a bit. You can join our discussion about not-for-profit organizations and the many things they can do, and it's a bit of a mind-expanding process here as we think about, gee, not every company has to make a profit in that sense. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange with comments, questions, thoughts, 800-838-3760 around the region. And email address is jx@jeffnet.org. To revisit the point that Wolfgang dropped off before the break, I think that the essence of what he's saying is he has seen nonprofits that are not terribly transparent, and they end up doing things, hiring individuals or companies that are for profit and therefore enriching people anyway.
It is a great point that Wolfgang raises. And I think the first thing to remember here is that if you compare them to equivalent for-profit organizations, hands down, there's so much more openness and accountability, especially with the emerging non-profit organizations that have business models sitting underneath them. For-profits don't have to declare their annual reports and statements and make them publicly available. That's not the same with nonprofits. The IRS requires those documents to actually be publicly available. So there's base transparency differences there. The other thing is that for-profits essentially do have you hooked in a market because that their bottom line is really what matters. Anytime you have a shareholder-based model or a notion of a growth-based model that sits underneath a for-profit business, it's all about selling you services, no matter whether you want them or need them, essentially. That's different within a nonprofit organization. Not all of them, but in most of them, because they're set up with social purpose in mind. This notion of nonprofits that actually contract for-profits, first of all, I think that's shifting in the sense that more nonprofits are entering the market and offering to collaborate with other nonprofit organizations. We're seeing that here in the Rogue Valley with more of those networks emerging. But the second thing, as I was alluding to earlier, is there is no capacity under IRS legislation that the IRS enforces to actually set things up with your mates, essentially. Set things up so that it's an inside job where you're dishing out public money that's come through to private individuals through contracts to for-profit organizations. The IRS takes very careful look at all those situations, and red flags commonly get put up when that kind of contracting is there, and they'll investigate and audit. In fact, nonprofits are audited much more, relatively speaking, than the for-profit sector. So I think that's important. We have scandals, we have situations that people have engaged with in their lifetime that would seem to suggest that nonprofits have a lot of problems. But what we're seeing is a trend towards much more transparency, openness, backed by the internet revolution and particularly applicable to nonprofit organizations who generally are more open, I found, than for-profits because they're not worried about their knowledge being captured by market competitors.
When you talk about the IRS and transparency, though, I mean, is this if you go to the extent of getting 501c3 or 501c4 nonprofit identity?
That's right.
And now if you don't have to get that to be a nonprofit organization, correct?
That's correct. The incorporation process happens within the state, but the tax exemption comes from the federal agencies. The fact is, though, that the majority of organizations go for the 501c3 status, which is the most relevant nonprofit status at that federal level. And as we're learning in the course that we're doing at the moment, it's even more of an encouragement to do that these days because in the past it took 9 months, 18 months to actually get your tax exemption through. These days, I've heard it's closer to 2 weeks because they've brought in the 1023 Easy form, which brings down the application process from a 27-page experience to a 3-page experience. We were just doing this in our training last night, and people were sitting there going, oh my God, I had no idea it was that easy. It only cost $400 to incorporate in Oregon as a nonprofit organization. Isn't that difficult either? It's just a one-pager. These are much, much easier processes than before, and that then allows you actually to put more time into the things that matter when it comes from a real transparency perspective and getting your business model up and running.
So is that that greater ease about paperwork reduction, or is this about an official policy to encourage people to register as nonprofits?
It's the former. The IRS realized that 80% of nonprofits in the U.S. were under a $50,000 turnover, and so that easy process relates to organizations that have a normal turnover of gross receipts under $50,000 over an average of 3 years. And they realized that with the backlog that they had, it was costing the U.S. taxpayer so much money to essentially be working through that when really we're talking about small fry here in relation to the budget. These small organizations under $50,000 turnover are not the kind that we should be spending government money on in terms of that audit process. We want to look at the organizations as they build, as well as having forms of accountability that ensure there's not embezzlement and the like going on, but to be looking at this with some perspective.
Another call here from Lance in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Donnie McClurk, and we're talking about not-for-profit organizations.
Good morning. Did you say Lance?
I did.
Good morning. So thank you for your important work, Donnie. In the program so far, you've talked about a number of important differences between conventional for-profit corporations and not-for-profits. I'd be glad if you'd address some of the egregious harms done by some corporations these days and for years, using their big money power to shape policy in the U.S. government, buying up legislators, and so on. I'm guessing that that's a thing that you and your friends and colleagues discuss. Can you address that for me?
Well, thanks, Lance. You're right. In the past, the for-profit companies, particularly in the 50s and 60s, played a much more productive and positive role, I think, in this country's development. Sadly, these days, money has led to power, particularly politically. And there's also been a lot of things that have been sold that didn't work out for communities in the way that they were promised. You take typically the local economic development process or economic development process more broadly, where people were campaigning essentially to bring in the big Walmarts into communities. And the promise was that it was going to create so many jobs and so much trickle-down prosperity. The reality is that that hasn't happened. Middle America has been gutted by a process of these big corporations coming in, selling so many promises, and then essentially extracting wealth from communities. And so I think you're right, that's led then to super PACs and a lot of power politically being concentrated within within the halls of power in Washington, D.C. The exciting counter to that is that communities are taking control, not in the social activist sphere, although that's happening, of course, but not so much there as in business itself. The rise of not-for-profit businesses actually signals a stark shift in the way that the economy is moving, and I believe we're moving towards a post-capitalist economy, a not-for-profit world, largely because capitalism set the platform for business competition. And now we're seeing not-for-profit businesses actually be more competitive, take market share from equivalent for-profit businesses. And that sets a very exciting stage for the future.
But it also scares the bejesus out of some people because they think, you know, when they don't hear the thing on the news about how, you know, the economy grew by X percent last month, they think that there's something wrong. In a world where we're conditioned to think that growth is a good thing, how do you convince people that steady state and just, you know, what you did last week is as good as what you're doing this week is okay?
I think you start with the fulfillment of needs. You start with reminding people something that sits within them already, which is that community matters. When we fulfill community needs and address what really matters, that is the core of an economy. That's traditionally, throughout history, the core of an economy. What's happened over the last 30 years is that economic growth, which in itself has actually been on a steady decline. So we are heading towards a zero-growth economy, whether we like it or not.
Is that simply because of constrainment of resources and things like that?
Constrainment of resources, productivity gains that are outstripping. We know that productivity gains have essentially led to job layoffs. You know, the data that we heard just this morning on this show of the last month's job figures and how small they are in comparison to the projections, less than half of what was projected, that signals, even though it's just 1 month, I'm telling you that that signals a long-term trend. This country is far from out of the woods in terms of that aspect. The exciting thing is the future lies with not-for-profit jobs. Why? Because not-for-profit business, imagine all businesses were not-for-profit. What then happens is that the profits made go back into communities rather than into a few people's back pockets. We wouldn't have the circumstances where 75 people control the same amount of wealth as 3.5 billion others. That inequality that sits under our system is actually creating the problems that not-for-profits and other organizations are trying to address. We need to think more creatively, and I think we are starting to move in this direction, towards an economy that actually addresses need, not greed. But it does so using the best of capitalism. It uses the market mechanism to still deliver services. So it's not some kind of socialist utopia. It actually uses the existing mechanisms, but it then focuses on a model of business that's more competitive, more productive, more creative, and more engaging with communities.
Are not-for-profits, because of the money trail and the way it works differently for them, limited in size and in scope? I mean, could you get something as big as Exxon be a not-for-profit?
You already do.
ExxonMobil, sorry.
You have Bosch, the engineering firm. It's 99.96% not-for-profit. There's a couple of family members who own a few little shares. The rest of it's owned by the foundation. So it's essentially acting as not-for-profit. It's a major international company. You have the world's largest non-profit with a turnover of over $450 million, and that's BRAC in Bangladesh, that works delivering health and education services as well as financial services and makes its money through craft stores and bakeries. So yes, you can have big organizations, but if you look at all of the organizations around the world and then almost 2 million not-for-profit organizations or non-profit organizations in the U.S. that have the 501c3 status, most of them are locally tethered. They're governed by a local board and they stick to community. So that concern around scale and, you know, a world with multinational not-for-profits, I think is not something we need to worry about. I think there's a nice equilibrium that emerges that's tethered to that local.
But then, I mean, there is something to be said for massiveness, I'm sure, at least on the parts of the people who like large corporations. I mean, they will say, for example, well, an ExxonMobil has the resources to go out and do things like, you know, drill miles and miles down into the earth to find oil. They can put the expense into this, even though they don't know for sure they're going to get a return when they start, which is something a not-for-profit would probably not be in a position to do.
Right. But if you think of a sovereign corporation like exists in Canada, where the government actually has these corporations that are essentially government entities, those have the resources to do that kind of thing. And big not-for-profits like BRAC certainly have the kind of money that they can put. And Bosch as well. Bosch, I know, for example, puts double the amount of the industry average into R&D. That's only because, and they say this on their website, it's only because they're a not-for-profit organization that they can do that. So, in fact, large not-for-profit organizations and government entities have more capacity to be creative in this space and to take risk than the equivalent for-profit businesses.
the theory is so interesting. I haven't talked about the practice very much, and you have this training going on that you're about halfway through. So what kinds of nonprofits are in this training, and what kinds of people from them, and what are some of the major points you're teaching them?
Jeffrey, we've got some wonderful projects. We have a project that is looking at recycling Christmas trees so that you have a living Christmas tree that's both dropped off and picked up each year. We have a program that's focused on tutoring for young people in the area, one-on-one with professional tutors. We have a program that's advocacy-based around bully breed dogs and raising awareness about those dogs, as well as a service for matching bully breed dogs in the shelter with homes that care. We have an arts organization focused on opera and its power to influence the arts field. There's a range of projects here, and we're actually working towards a public presentation night that exists that's going to happen on May 1st, Friday, May 1st, at 6 p.m. in the Meese Auditorium in the Arts Center at SOU. And we're going to be inviting all of the projects that are in part of this program to pitch their idea in just 2 or 3 minutes and what they're offering to the community through this new project and what they need. And the community coming in will be asking for suggested donations of $20, and that money will get split amongst the projects, but it will get split based on everyone's votes. So people will have sticker dots, 10 or 20 of them, and they'll have a sheet of paper with all the different projects, and they can allocate where they would like to see their money or the money of others if they're not contributing split up. And they can also write on a post-it note and say what they'd like to offer that project by way of other forms of support. So it's a really exciting way to engage the community on May 1st.
It sounds like the angel investors showcase, just without the venture capital.
Just without the venture capital. Some of the other things that we're learning about the program are that when we start with what's working, there's incredible potential here. We're looking at what's called a lean business model as well, and how you actually test your assumptions rather than just saying, we think the community needs this, and then finding out they don't. So there's lots of exciting learnings that are happening with the Not-for-Profit Way program.
Always an interesting conversation with Donnie McClurkin from Cascades Hub and the Post Growth Institute. Thanks so much for joining us once again on the Jefferson Exchange.
Great to be here. Thanks, Jeffrey.